The anecdote for completely non-technical people I always use is the monks in the whatever century when the printing press was invented. They're like, those are not real books. They're coming from a press. They're not handmade by the praised people, and they don't have every starting letter is not like typography, crazy art. Piece of shit. Don't throw it out. We don't want it. But at the end of the day, we still probably hand paint books, but there's like it's very specific skill even these days, and they probably still exist for certain reasons. But most books are printed. Oof. The same thing with AI. I feel like there's a the content market is gonna explode or is exploding already anyway. The amount of images that need to be generated are exploding. So for starters, before I go into the whole getting replaced by AI problem, is also I think the biggest thing to note is that with that, also the hunger and the need for content is going to skyrocket. So you might need to you might have less jobs because certain things go away, but there's more that needs to be created. So there's in general, I feel like there's not going to be less jobs at the end of the day. But people need to adapt. But that's a thing that happens. An industry that's 30 years old maximum, but we've already reinvented the way we're doing things, probably four times. We went from like big computers and rendering things by hand, Star Wars style, and typing into text editors to like scanning film, and suddenly film was replaced with video, and then it's like then ray tracing came a thing, and we started to get reflections in music videos and stuff, or Chrome robots or whatever, or Terminators.
Welcome to UFO, a podcast where artists, musicians, and Web3 builders talk about the future, a place for revolutionary ideas. I'm your host, Nick Hollins, and on today's show, Atara. Real name, Johannes Sam, Academy Award-winning creative technologist, futurist, and Web3 artist. With two decades innovating in visual effects and film, raised by 80s and 90s VFX and video games, an explorative creator of generative art through coding, and most recently, co-founder of a new NFT collection, DALI Punks. Reimagining the iconic CryptoPunks through a visual AI engine stack to create a new interpretation, reflecting the traits of the original NFTs, such as hoodies, cigarette, and eye patch, only that each image is now totally unique, and the eye patch prompts turn into pirates. Johannes and myself got to know each other earlier this year as part of our artist collective at Voyager. He's originally from Germany, but longtime based in Sydney, Australia, which is also my original hometown. His projects and art releases have been on my radar, and what he's sharing behind the scenes at Voyager in our meetups and conversations, expanding the field of knowledge with the latest explorations and uses of technology. In this episode, we talk about his visual effects career in the film industry, exploring creativity through coding, mathematics, and technology, the latest from AI generative platforms such as DALL-E 2, Stable Diffusion, and Midjourney, and of course, going behind the scenes for the creation of their new project, DALL-E Punks, with a mint still available and links in the show notes. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsors helping to put UFO on the air, starting with Zerion. UFO is a podcast that brings together the brightest builders, creators, and founders shaping the cultural side of Web3, and Zerion is the perfect wallet for these active citizens. Zerion combines every corner of Web3 in a simple and intuitive app for self-custodial humans. Discover the hottest NFT collections, track your DeFi rewards, and vote in DAOs across 10 plus chains. Come along and check out their new app on mobile. You can get started at zerion.io, that's zerion.io. Lens Protocol is the open source tech stack for building decentralized social media applications. It's a new era for social media in Web3. And Lens isn't a social media app. It's a protocol to let Web3 social apps thrive, a permissionless and transparent social graph that is owned by the user. With Lens, your followers go with you to whatever application you want to use. And instead of being trapped inside the walled garden of an algorithm, Lens lets you choose the way that you want to experience your social media. And UFO listeners can claim a Lens handle and get started. And right now, the best way to pick up an invite is interacting with UFO on Twitter. Follow us, retweet, post replies, come and engage with us. And UFO is available on all Lens apps at ufoclub.lens. Now let's jump in with Atara, aka Johannes Sam. So yeah, like from the start, I'd love to ask about your backstory, sort of career backstory in visual effects and like in film and, you know, piece of curiosity, like you won an Academy Award. What up with that? I'm just sort of curious to kind of get your origin backstory a little in like what led you up to, you know, what have you been up to for the last decade or so?
Decade or so, 15, 20 years, yeah. Yeah, thanks, man. I've switched from education to non-education, but I have never really switched my passion for CG like since I'm like 14 or whatever. Then we watched DVDs back in the days. Who still remembers those where there was like extras on it and you could watch all the visual effects or like all the behind the scenes stuff. And seeing Terminator and, you know, Jurassic 2, that is, and Jurassic Park and stuff like this, I kind of wanted to do that. And then very young, started to like, you know, abuse my computer that I had, my Pentium 2 that I got at one point, and DOS and 3D Studio DOS and stuff like this, just to like get used to 3D animation. And never went to university, went straight into like, you know, visual effects in Germany. And then, but went back to university later to get a master's just because I didn't realize that everything is actually based on math and, you know, formulas and heavy coding. And I realized that if I want to become a better artist or creator or whatever, I want to really learn how to code. So I did that and then went to Australia just before the summer. And then 8 years later, I was still there. Or 9 years, you know, had met my now wife and, you know, all this stuff. And so then did worked on lots of movies in Australia. It was very confusing at the beginning because I worked in a movie called Australia and had just moved to Australia. So it was a classic conversation. I was like, so you're working on Australia? No, we know we moved there, but what's the movie called? And I'm like, I did like some crowd. Anyway, I'm always kind of writing the tools and then using them myself. So I was like, for that movie, for example, I made a crowd tool for cows, very unsexy, but you know, it's like cows, flocks of cows that are driven through the Australian outback, and obviously had to be done somehow. So we wrote the whole crowd system from scratch and then used it straight away to make the shots and do all this stuff. So this is kind of the ideal state for me to kind of make tools or software and then using them straight away to create art or solve problems creatively. Right. And yeah, and when he asked what up with the Academy Award, it's like, well, I was in Australia. I was one of the couple of people who had a similar idea, which was to add depth to images. And what that means is that, you know, right now, your standard JPEG has, you know, every pixel has, you know, red, green, blue color value. That's it. So what we thought is we could add a distance for every pixel, because if you have 3D rendered information, you know exactly how far this pixel is actually away from camera. And we were doing an animated feature, so everything was computer generated. And that gives you certain superpowers if you have a depth information, because rather than saying, you know, this layer goes over this layer, you can basically say they exist in the same space. You have an owl that claws onto a tree. You know, a part of the claw is behind and a part of the claw is in front of it. There's always a problem when you put those two images together. You have to either use the tree and the render of the owl to not have a claw where there shouldn't be one, or you have to like do really complicated slicing of like, you know, using one thing and then mask is really complicated, or something really simple, like I grab onto a tree. And that we solved that basically by having the depth information of the pixel, and they would sort themselves. So if the claw would know this bit of the claw is behind the tree, so I need to show the tree, and the other way around. And while this is simple, nice, it has all sorts of like implications for workflows. Like for example, that if the tree changes, like let's say the tree bark needs to be a bit thicker or whatever. In the olden days, you would have to re-render the owl because the tree bark got thicker. And obviously that's annoying. And if you have the tree and the owl completely disconnected, because they can be added together at any point for free, basically, you can have, you know, things can change later on, and it's very more efficient and blah, blah. That said, that's the technology that we wrote with a couple of other people. There's lots of, you know, if you want to go down the VFX route, I can tell you lots of anecdotes about, you know, how we use that or whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, so something I've picked up from our previous conversations and stuff and about your work in the film industry and all this is that, you know, you essentially developed a reputation as always building at the edges and sort of exploring on the technology side and always kind of unearthing what was new in that area, which I think is quite interesting, the kind of, yeah, the technology focus in how you've approached your work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really cool. Thanks, man, for noticing that, because it's really been my edge to randomly find a piece of technology and then like think that's the future. And I have to have the same conversation with lots of people about, like, you know, is this really a thing? Are you sure adding triple our disk space for an image? Because, you know, we have to save all those depth informations and our disk. Are you sure this is going to work? This is all this stuff. But then I just stick with it for a couple of years and it turns into a thing. Luckily, so far it always worked. It was first, it was deep image stuff. Then it was real-time engines. We used them really early on, trying to really get them into the film industry. That was, you know, before Mandalorian and stuff like this was a thing. And yeah, and we rented like commercial stuff like this and tried to do stuff in real time. And then the next thing was crypto in general. I was like, you know, we should have, you know, see if we could kind of communicate or use Web3-ish stuff. And that kind of led to nowhere, to be honest. That led to me being into crypto, but not really. It's not that the visual effects company now pays every, the visual effects industry now all uses cryptocurrency to pay their artists. But at least it was kind of a thing. And now it's obviously AI art and procedurally generated worlds and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I'm doing it for a long time. And the Academy Award is kind of my, I can always pull it out as be like, see it work once, trust me, which is nice. That and the green card that it kind of came with at the time. It was very easy to get a green card in America afterwards.
You've gone super deep into AI generative works over the past months and for a while. And before that, a lot of tests in like deep fake sort of tech and stuff like that. I'm wondering, like, what sparked your curiosity in these areas?
That's a good question, and I have to go really far back, so pardon my storytelling mode. But it all started with, I think, deepfakes were one thing, because it made it clear that AI tech or AI neurally rendered images of some sort would make it into VFX. Because I was like, before it was all a bit trippy pictures and arty, like the first Google, what was it called? The deep dream stuff that was cool and it looked cool. And it was, you know, oh, we can make images with it, not just classify them and stuff like that. So that was really cool. And while machine learning in general was always on my radar for like data problems at the time, like there's lots of things with mocap data and, you know, very kind of, again, very unsexy and like, data-driven VFX-y tasks, but like if you have a bunch of mocap data that has been cleaned up by an animator, and you have a bunch of mocap backup data that's raw from the suits, you know, from the people jumping around in the suits, why not to come up with some sort of machine learning solution to clean up mocap data or rotoscoping? You know, the whole classic like painting black and white images frame by frame by frame around people to do background foreground separation. Those are all things where we have 30 years almost worth of, or green screen keying. Those are all kind of problems where we have a lot of data for in VFX. And as soon as machine learning kind of was somewhat on the horizon as a technology that was, you know, usable for us, you know, in VFX, when, you know, NVIDIA and, you know, other GPU stuff came to the forefront. So it was kind of a thing. Again, I experimented a lot with that anyway. So when Deep Dream came around and then deepfakes came out, that was kind of I had enough of rendering triangles at that point. I was like, screw this, we will have some sort of hallucinated or inferred image generation thing at one point in like 10 years or whatever. But it's over with triangles for me. And so I tried to kind of go down that route. I tried with a friend of mine, Mariano. We tried to kind of do NeRFs before NeRFs were a thing. We were literally doing the same thing where we were like trying to render 3D objects, you know, new nerves for everybody who doesn't really isn't really deep into the matter, is like a neural light field. So what it means is you take a bunch of pictures and you put them into some sort of brain, and then it remembers the scene. And it sounds like a lot like what usually people in VFX call photogrammetry, where you make a 3D mesh out of lots of pictures. But the problem with that is that you don't have reflections and stuff like this that are dependent on where you're standing. So if you think of a lake, and you, if you walk past the lake and take a lot of pictures, obviously the reflection changes a lot from picture to picture, so you can't really use that. But with Nerf, that is cool because you have all this information baked in. So if you then make a 3D camera move around that lake, the reflections are always perfect. Long story short, we thought we could do that, you know, before it became a thing. And, it, you know, we saw results that it would, in theory, work to get to use pictures to train something and then get a picture back from a camera angle you hadn't seen before. And it would make sense. And then, you know, there was Nerfs, which was a great thing when that came out for the first time. And yeah, and it as soon as we had those text-to-image translators very early with, it was called VQGAN and Clip. Somebody on, I think on Reddit, had like a thing where they used text to generate images. And there were, you know, nothing from what the Midjourneys and the Stable Diffusion 2.0s and the whatever DALLIs are creating these days. It was very abstract. And then I think in my Instagram from like 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, you can see those kind of first moves of stuff. And I was fascinated because, again, you know, I'm the one who sees something like this and then thinks 5 years from now, where will that be? And I couldn't, in being a futurist and all, I didn't expect it to be that quick to go into like a year and a half from like kind of abstractish paintings with like that kind of resembled the words that we told it to do. And it was more like a curiosity to like a whole movement and the whole, you know, questionable ethics, you know, all the stuff that comes up with it so quickly, that I'm happy that it does, and that I'm happy to talk about a lot. But it's interesting that it happened so quickly. So I can only imagine how quickly it will continue. And and for VFX, there's obviously a big deal if you can just say, you know, Spider-Man swinging through New York City and it appears. It's obviously like assuming that will work at one point. That is obviously a thing that visual effects companies have to look into quickly.
Yeah. So on this point, what do you think sparked this like recent Cambrian explosion in the proliferation of these platforms? And you know, what could you tell us and the audience about the various AI gen platforms now available? It feels like it's definitely jumped up in the zeitgeist over the last 3 to 6 months. And now, you know, seemingly most people have heard about one of DALL-E 2, Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, this kind of stuff. Like, why do you feel like it's having its moment now?
I mean, without Nostradamusifying it too much, but I feel like there is a, it is kind of a perfect storm of compute prices going down and being available, but also all those networks becoming available and enough people thinking in those kind of machine learning AI terms to plug two things together. Because I think as far, again, please fact check me, but as least as I perceived this whole development, there was Clip before, which was, you know, before I said, you know, the first kind of AI text to image stuff that I was exposed to and used was called VQGAN plus Clip. So Clip is actually something that can guess what is in an image and then convert it to text. So it's actually not really what we're doing. It's just one building block of the bigger puzzle. And VQGAN was, again, a general adversarial network, which are really good in just making up stuff that was trained on a lot of images to make up a lot of stuff. So those two existed, but nobody actually thought of putting them together. And then I don't know who was the first person, so you have to figure that out. I think it was a person on a Discord. I remember an early diffusion early Discord server people. I think he went to Adobe or something, but they just plugged it in together, and suddenly, you know, we had basically something that generated images and something that told you what it saw in the image, and then you could feed that back, and you know, with the text that you you gave it to the initially, and suddenly we changed the image and see, does it look more like a cat on a skateboard? Oh, it doesn't. Okay, let's go in the other direction. So cool, go in the other direction. Does it look more like a cat with on a skateboard? Yes, it does. Cool. Let's keep walking down that path till we are after lots of computing, we are at an area where we like to be, and it looks, we're confident this is now a cat on a skateboard. So they plugged those two together and it worked. So I don't think that the people who came up with either necessarily had those in mind, but because they were available, people could plug them together. And I think that's very, very important, is that we allow that. We allow, you know, the next thing is obviously text to video, which is then based on the people's work that the text to images. Then there could be music or sound to a video, image. We actually did it in one of the very early Discord servers. Somebody figured out a way to take, instead of a text prompt, to take a sound prompt. And I think that was really cool, because there was another network that would basically convert sound to text. And that was just the man in the middle, basically. And the cool part about that was that if you played it, raindrops falling off from hitting a puddle, then it would show you raindrops hitting a puddle. See what I mean? Like, it was the sound of that was represented. So music wouldn't make sense at all, because if you had a music, then it would just, you know, music. But what does music as a text mean to a picture? It was very abstract. But as soon as there were sounds involved, like banging, hammering, whatever, it would start to make sense. And it was a really crazy experiment. I thought you would appreciate being like a sound guy. And we should maybe get that back out and see what, I have no idea what the current state of the art is actually on sound to image.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, if we look at the kind of the DALL-E 2s, Midjourneys and stuff like that, like, the sense that I get, without being a heavy user of them myself, but I'm definitely like curious in them and stuff like that. But it seems like the level of their capability is accelerating, and, you know, new editions of it, iterations of it and stuff, like, keeps updating. So that keeps improving. And from having other conversations with yourself and other folks who are into the kind of AI gen sort of stuff. And yeah, I've had that conversation before about music, like, is AI eventually just going to give us a new Beatles album that Hendrix is playing on and James Jameson's on bass or whatever, like, you know, that kind of thing. And if you look at the kind of the improvement in some of these platforms, and maybe it's just the nature of reality or technology, that, like, if it continues to improve, maybe the best pop albums in the future. I mean, the top 20 of pop music right now sounds like it was created by an algorithm anyway, right? So we're most of the way there.
Yeah, I mean, this goes down so many interesting routes. I still owe you an explanation of what are the different platforms for AI generation, and try to sneak that in while I answer your question.
Totally.
But I think it's very interesting to imagine those kind of scenarios, because that's exactly the scale that most people have with visual effects, or even with right now with concept art. Like, if you think about it, the people who are kind of the most scared, or have the most reason to be scared, are concept artists, because a director or a storyboard artist or something. And people could just, you know, had to hire them and to get their movies made, kind of. And now a director, I'm not saying the final concept out of all Marvel movies is done by Midjourney next week, but at least a director can sit there and can start some stuff and start in a meeting. It's like, hey, it could look like this, or a little bit like this, a little bit like this, which is, you know, great for them, but not so great for the storyboard artist, because suddenly, oh, the designer or whatever, because suddenly, rather than having that discussion and that input into the process, they kind of get shown a picture and say, like, now make this real. And it's kind of not obviously as satisfying. So I understand their struggles and their problems with it. And obviously the whole question about, like, is there bias in the data set? Is there, you know, are there other artist styles that it builds upon that are not credited properly? All those kind of questions. I acknowledge them fully. But I think it's like a tool. And the tool evolves. And, you know, it's the same thing with Photoshop. Like, the first time Photoshop came out, it was really hard to use, probably. I didn't use Photoshop 1.0, but, you know, it was not as easy, you know, to retouch a face, because now you go on a YouTube video and, you know, duplicate this layer, divide it by this layer, multiply by this, and then paint a bit here, and you do your tutorial, and suddenly somebody's Photoshopped. And, you know, 20 years ago when Photoshop came out, that was technically probably possible, but nobody knew that. And it's the same with AI tools. It's like 3 years, but it's just the speed and the, you know, obviously the impact is higher than Photoshop. But it's the same thing. Like we were 2 years ago, like, oh, it's going to be, you know, sometime in the future, we type whatever we want and we will get a photorealistic image back. And then, you know, 2 years later, it's actually already possible. And you have Midjourney. When Midjourney appeared for the first time, it was cool because it was an integration into Discord, which is a tool that we all use to communicate. And it was new to me, at least, that, you know, use Discord as an input into a tool. So I appreciated that as well. And it looked really good. It still does. And it still does cool things now. The newest thing, one of the new things, is combining two images. If you have a Pixar animation movie still frame and your face, then you can kind of make you in the style of Pixar, and it looks really good. So that's kind of a cool thing. Then there is obviously DALL-E, which has the biggest kind of OpenAI behind it, which is a big startup, I guess, probably not a startup anymore, company, but these days, and they really excel to me by having their AI ethics as advanced as possible. So I got into their, you know, artist program or whatever at one point, and there was like a huge meeting with lots of people where it was all discussed what we're allowed to do and what, you know, what the company ethics are and what they want to represent and all this kind of stuff. And it was really, really good to hear that people would actually do that. And yeah, it's really good in advance, and they have a lot of thought behind it. And you, from the get-go, you couldn't do anything obviously sexual or anything violent or anything like this, and that was pretty cool. Oh, that is still pretty cool. The recent NFT project that I did, I used DALL-E a lot. And then there's Stable Diffusion, which is open, so it's like the Wild West, but it gets pushed a lot, and there's lots of like little add-ons and stuff because the whole thing is open, or kind of open. So those are the different, you know, stages of where we are at, or what those kind of big players represent. What it means for us is just, you know, there's just multiple tools, so suddenly we have to adapt to the tools, and you only see the progress because people are using it and people come up with new ideas of, you know, as I said in the beginning of this whole thing, like you're putting two seemingly unrelated projects together and suddenly you create something crazy. That will happen again with video. That will happen again with, you know, how does 3D mix into that? Do you take your games? It's already happened that people do footage of a city and train a network with the corresponding GTA, TTA game sequences, and suddenly GTA looks photorealistic because they have used a neural network with real pictures. Stuff like this is gonna come very, very soon in games, and I'm pretty sure one of the next, a couple of years from now, maybe even a game of Call of Duty will have like AI generated backgrounds that are based on real pictures, or, you know, based on real places and stuff like this. And I think that's the really cool part. It's where kind of AI art, procedurally generated stuff, nerfs, you know, AI in general, machine learning comes in handy. But neural rendering is just so much, you know, faster and better than anything else, that it's gonna win at one point. It's just right now very hard to control, and that's another question that is interesting to think about in my mind, is how will it change the way our whole creative process works. Is because a low-hanging fruit are easy to do, so you don't have to, you have more time to actually think bigger, so that might be one thing. But the other thing is how you control that thing is very hard at this point, because it's like working with a you know, creative person in the room. Like you have to ask it what to do. By it, I mean the AI entity, network, whatever you call it. And it's not as, you know, if you draw it by hand, you can say, I want this specific branch 25% redder. And that happens in VFX, and that's why stuff doesn't get done, because, you know, people can do that and will do that. And suddenly the, you know, the toenail greens are not dramatic enough of a monster. And then you're like, okay, let's go back and do this again. And at the end of the day, it's like, well, does it really matter? Did it really matter? It probably mattered for the director, so it's good for the whole movie, and, you know, for the whole thing. I don't deny that, but it would be better if we had tools that are really good at creating it and giving some of this to the director, but then wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't have control anymore about necessarily without going in and painting again frame by frame, you know, but, you know, fine tuning the, you know, the sub skin, you know, redness by like 2%, just because we can. It would be interesting how that changes actually the whole process of getting stuff approved. I was like, hey, the AI did that. Do you want it now? Or do you want me to get the VFX army involved and you give it to you in 2 weeks for 10 times or 50 times the money? But if you get it now, you have it straight away, but it looks like this. You want it? My question is what will go quicker if we have AI tools that allow us again to what we call in VFX, quite frankly, pixel fucking? Like, are we building tools that allow us to do that? Or will the whole thing change and actually, because of the speed and turnaround times, it will just evolve into a more of a collaboration with the AI? And then, you know, rather than going and kind of minutely changing an image, you're like, hey, I actually want the other AI to have a go at this, you know, because I know you have two networks that do Spider-Man and the other one is better for like the shiny one. So try the other one and see what that gives you. Okay, you have this and this. Okay, I picked that one. Rather than going in kind of hand painting stuff. But that's kind of something that I see a lot because I'm working starting with little music videos, and we're still in the stage where you do something and people are so amazed by it that they love it. But I feel like at one point when it becomes in a year from now, when everybody has seen music videos with AI generated crazy pictures in it, then people are more like, oh, now I'm going to start to really art direct this again, which is cool. But I'm just mentioning it as a point that it is a thing, you know, that something needs to give, and whatever it is, it's fine. We have to adapt to it, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, so it's like in this moment, like the tech and the tools and what it can do in terms of its novelty is kind of outrunning how much, as you say, like art direction is actually needed at this point. I kind of think of like those music videos from the early 2000s where it was always like a rapper or a pop artist in kind of a spaceship with some kind of, you know, the kind of the Missy Elliott type vibes and Aaliyah and stuff like that, right? And like, love those videos, but like everyone was at the time was so excited about how that looked. They were just smashing that stuff out all the time. But I think it's very interesting, as you say, that like the novelty is outrunning the need to get really particular about it this time. But you're right, like pretty soon people are gonna kind of be like, all right, like I've seen that now or whatever. I feel like this is an interesting way to ask about whether creatives and like this notion of creatives and artists being concerned about being replaced entirely by these AI gen platforms, but you're kind of speaking to, well, look, these are new tools and artists will make new things which are entirely their own style and creation, but simply using these tools.
I mean, there's the anecdote for completely non-technical people I always use is the monks whatever century when the printing press was invented. They're like, those are not real books. They're coming from a press. They're not handmade by the praised people, and they don't have every starting letter is not like typography, crazy art. Piece of shit, don't throw it out. We don't want it. But you know, at the end of the day, we still probably hand paint books, but there's like, it's very specific skill even these days, and they probably still exist for certain reasons, but you know, most books are printed. Oof. The same thing with AI. I feel like there's the content market is going to explode or is exploding already anyway. The amount of images that need to be generated are exploding. So for starters, before I go into the whole getting replaced by AI problem, is also, I think the biggest thing to note is that with that, also the hunger and the need for content is going to skyrocket. So you might need to, you might have less jobs because certain things go away, but there's more that needs to be created. So there's, in general, I feel like there's not going to be less jobs at the end of the day. But people need to adapt. But that's a thing that happens. In an industry that's 30 years old maximum, but we've already reinvented the way we're doing things, you know, probably four times. You know, we went from like big computers and, you know, rendering things by hand, Star Wars style, and typing into text editors to like scanning film, and suddenly film was replaced with video. And then, you know, it's like within ray tracing camera thing, and we started to get reflections in music videos and stuff, or Chrome robots or whatever, or Terminators. And suddenly, whereas all still a hack, and you know, I know people that were professional shader writers for a living, and they were going in and kind of looking at the material, and they were writing mathematical formulas how to approximate how light interacts with leather efficiently. And that was their job. And then, you know, or how light interacts with the skin of Davy Jones in Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever. Like, there's like that one thing that does nothing else but the Davy Jones skin. Or, you know, I'm not sure if that is really true, but there's like a, you know what I mean? Like, there were people who did nothing else, but because we couldn't afford rendering things by simulating light, because we didn't have enough computing power, we had to kind of trick it. We had to fake it. That job doesn't really exist anymore, because we now we have light simulators that run on GPUs in almost real time, where you can, all the bouncing, 17 bounces between the reflection of this and this and this, just get computed for you. And you don't need to fake it anymore. So those shader writers are technically out of job. I'm pretty sure they're still doing stuff in the lighting department. They just have moved on from like faking leather to, like, you know, setting up other things. Like, it's just your tools evolve, and you're, and yes, AI is going to be a big replacement for lots of things, but it's not necessarily a VFX thing. I mean, there's doctors who are going to be replaced with AIs when it goes to finding certain things in x-rays, or, you know, there is going to be lawyers that build up cases that used to have like four assistants that would go through old case files and then cross-reference or whatever. They're probably, an AI is probably better at compiling those documents and writing their speeches or whatever, preparing their arguments, when then the big lawyers come in and still do stuff. But, you know, those other jobs, they're in danger as well. But are they really in danger, or are they just changing? Are you just becoming a lawyer quicker, or are you realizing you hate being a lawyer quicker and do something else? And, you know, whatever it is, like, or, you know, I'm pretty sure that the people that do rotoscoping for a living, they find other jobs that are probably at the end of the day more satisfying to them than that. And I feel like this is a thing that the society as a whole has to answer. It's like how machines and automation is going to deal with society, and VFX, or the generating the content creation industry, might be a good example of how to deal with it. And it's because it's coming quicker than we thought. You know, we thought the creatives would be the last ones to go, but it turns out that, you know, if you have a system where, you know, a client can come in and by typing a bunch of words come back with a picture and say, hey, I want that, a whole high-end creative area is in danger as well. But it doesn't, again, I don't think that necessarily will go away, because just because they have a picture they like doesn't mean they have a story around it. They have the whole campaign around it. They haven't thought of everything that is involved in making this. So it's just going to transform. It's going to change. And, you know, in my relatively short career, it's 20 years, it's not that little, but it's compared to, you know, a lifetime is not that much. We changed everything like 3-4 times already. So as long as the next time. So we're just starting slowly.
So, like, leaving aside the sort of professional lens of this stuff, and kind of, you know, recognizing that, as you say, like, technology makes certain functions unnecessary for a person to do that, but there's always new stuff for people to do and all that kind of stuff. And another topic is like, of the last little while, we're seeing artists who are actively opposed to the AI gen kind of platforms, but having their own visual style and practice as a text prompt in the very algorithms. So it's like people are producing AI gen content and works referencing a certain photographer, saying, show me something in like this in the style of this photographer. And so it outputs these things. So I find that interesting. I mean, like, it's getting at, like, you know, notions of who is the author and all this kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, first of all, absolutely, you're right. It is a problem. And if I would be a famous painter, and people could just type my stuff in a prompt in the style of Johannes Saum, and it would look perfect, and then would sell it and would make a lot of money with it, I would not like that either, of course not. That said, copying with your own you know, intent. Music, for example, for in your realm is like sampling. It's just a thing that you constantly do, and you there's a system in place that sometimes does and sometimes doesn't work in how to deal with those kind of copying processes. At the end of the day, especially with art, it comes. There's a story, and you're what you're trying to say and trying to do is more important. It sounds cheesy, but it's more important than the picture. If you're just there to copy somebody's style, you might sell a couple somewhere, but you're gonna be found out quite quickly. And you might make a bit of money, but you're not gonna get stupidly rich from it. I would assume. Maybe there's people that do it, but you know, there. In what I see is that people still need to have a character, a story, and something to say. And hey, if they would use my style to tell their story, to get an audience, and to become successful, that benefits me as well. As long as they're open about it, and as they're not saying, "Hey, I sat there and you know trained my own network by painting for 15 years," da da da. So it's like, hey, I'm standing on the shoulder of giants. Here are some of the giants openly, but you know, here's my story, and you know, you like what I do, and that's it. Like, I feel like it's a common thing in art, especially to copy and to get inspired by other people's work. And you can do it, like with most of things in life, you can do it in a nice way, and you can do it in a dickish way. And I would hope that we would have the audience, by making it open and free, educated enough that they understand what it is what it entails to make this kind of stuff, and that they can start to understand, like when I put a piece out, that it's not me typing three words in a computer, having a smoke coming back, and then here's a picture. It's like, it's not how it works. It's like, you still have years and years of experience. You do experimentation, takes hours and late nights of getting somewhere. You then take the output of four different things, mix and mash them together, do your own networks, try to break something, rip a layer off a network, you know, try it over here, unplug some cables and see what sounds good, kind of thing. And then you come up with a piece that you're proud of, and it is you, kind of thing. And then people will see that. And that's where I think the true power of it all stands. And you can even give that back to people. And suddenly, you know, suddenly there's things like NFT and procedural art, which I'm also very in right now, you know, more of a thing. And you can say, hey, change a prompt. Like, here's a picture that I made, but you know, here's a part of the prompt that made this. But if you want to change those things, or here's like five different things I've pre-prepared for you, which, you know, what do you feel in the mood for today? And you own a digital art piece, and it can change over time, over its lifetime, over how often it's sold, over how whatever, how you what you want to be, what you need to be. That's cool. But that's a whole different art form, you know, and it's a whole different story.
Yeah, I think you just hit on three or four really salient points or aspects that sort of resonate with Web3 and crypto culture, the kind of the CCO thing, the kind of the open source of creative and inspiration and stuff like that. Also sampling in music as a notion, you know, like it's quite accepted at this point that it's an art form in itself, like to say the least. Many of the greatest albums ever made are sample-based sort of things, you know, the kind of Paul's Boutique or J Dilla and all these incredible things. But also when you know, mentioning like standing on the shoulders of giants, taking inspiration from other things, you know, your recent project with Dali Punks being inspired by CryptoPunks and kind of exploring in that lore and stuff like that, and the culture of which, you know, CryptoPunks is coming from. I'd love to talk about kind of what inspired that project, you know, what was the kind of what was the creative process like? What is Dali Punks, Dunks? Like, yeah, let's talk about that recent project.
Sure. And I think you're absolutely right by saying that, you know, the sampling thing is just accepted by now. And we will all figure out how this works. And especially with the crypto stuff, is it one of what was, you know, educating the audience, and the other one was figuring out a good way of actually crediting the right people. And I think especially with effects, I have to bring up Iron Man all the time. I only just worked very short on one Iron Man movie, but you know, I don't know, it seems to be the best VFX example. But why is the person that models Iron Man for a movie not paid by, you know, whatever Netflix for how often Iron Man gets, you know, this actual piece of his modeling appears on somebody's screen with a cryptocurrency or an automated process, and suddenly the royalties go all the way back down, and suddenly you might have a democratization of a market, because suddenly the person who models Iron Man also models this indie movies superhero at the same quality that he does for Marvel these days for free, basically, because, you know, only two of them need to become hit movies and he gets his paycheck that's probably bigger than what he gets right now or what they get right now. So that is that's also, you know, the other thing is like to think about, if you think about generative art or generated stuff in crypto, is that there's also in the future hopefully a way to have different business models than just like going to an office doing something and then some other studio makes billions of dollars on that. That might actually be kind of refreshing you. Which leads to Dali Punks quite nicely, because when I worked at Scanline, I met Mois, my good friend, who is through a series of events really into crypto, and he started Genetic Chain with others. He asked me again, he's like, hey, do you, and he saw my first, you know, generative AI stuff. And we started chatting a lot about it. And I really got from a crypto, like, you know, connoisseur or whatever, just like standing on the fields of like looking at it and, you know, thinking about what it could do for exactly stuff like as I just said for VFX, to actually somebody who suddenly sells NFTs and, you know, really gets into contracts and stuff like this, which is awesome. And I released a collection at Genetic Chain called Serena Nemo, where we're just exploring some procedural generated shapes and forms. And the idea is, and still is, to release more of them. It's just the market is a bit stressful right now. But the idea is just to explore, you know, how generative art, and how we can slowly push it from like 2D to 3D to whatever.
Quickly jumping in about Serene Animo, like that actual collection, rather than just blazing straight by it in conversation. I think like you were dropping that around about the time that we're kind of starting to get in touch, like through the Voyager Artist Collective and stuff like that. And you'd put out this work, like jumping off the page, the basis, I'm quoting this, the basis for the collection is the work of German mathematician David Hilbert. His discovery of his type of space-filling curves in 1891, inspiring this, you know, exploring its unique and fractal properties, and kind of, I'll drop a link in the show notes on the blog, UFO blog, so people can check this out. But, you know, the result of this is this really cool, psychedelic, super colorful collection, and, you know, all these curves, and yeah, I found it. And also that I believe on the website, like visitors, audience can go and like play with it themselves and kind of change the parameters and like create their own results on screen, which is super cool.
Yeah, I think that, thank you, man. That is, it's very fun, because that was the whole point of it. It was just to not make trippy art, is to make trippy art that you can still change. And so if you own it, you can still have, because it's procedural and trippy, and, you know, I do a lot of procedural stuff, you know, the tiles on the wall in a Disney movie or whatever, you know, those are all technically procedurally generated art pieces. But it's just, you know, a different context. So pulling it out of there, giving it to people via Web3 interface, where they can own a piece and then change a piece, and that change is still registered on the blockchain. So if you then sell it, it's sold with that change in it. I thought it's really exciting. And at the same time, I was just experimenting with those kind of, to take another step back, I was doing, a couple of years back, I was doing one of the first VR fractal explorers, just as a side project. We were basically just having a coffee, me and my friend Aaron, and he was like, I wonder, now you're doing all this VR stuff for Framestore, and why don't you, I wonder how fractal would look like. And I was like, okay. And then so I wrote something that kind of worked happily quite quickly. They're like, oh god, we have to go. And then it was so much fun, you know, flying through a fractal with in stereo with VR. They're like, we have to explore this more, because it was not 90 frames a second. You got like really disoriented because you're flying in this like soup of mathematics. It's really like trippy sometimes. It was not as easy to just, you know, digest it. So we had to really come up with, over years, to come up with different kind of rules of what worked and what doesn't work. I also knowing that this is not my main project. I was just, you know, in coffee breaks and, you know, after hours, or like, you know, when I was rendering other real important commercials, you know, I was just working on it. So we figure out ways to kind of shrink your head to different sizes to see different scale of the fractal and all this kind of stuff, and different formulas, and how we could actually slowly push it to 90 frames per second. And we got there, and that's where we had a GDC talk about it and gave a demo out for free, just as a, you know, for people to explore it. Again, probably because it was a side project, it never really went anywhere, but that made me very much fluent with what's called SDF functions. So it's like, oh, how all those fractals are rendered. It's like they're all formulas, fields, and you use different rendering techniques to called ray marching or sphere tracing. There's lots of like different technical terms of boring how people can look up that, you know, how you bring those to actual life and actually how to render those. And taking those and then stripping it all back down and going to really simple shapes in 2D was basically the first thing with this collection. And at the same time, I was doing a lot of other work trying to come up with different compressions for images and all this kind of weird stuff using those Hilbert curves. And Hilbert curves are basically curves that go through every point in space at one point. You just have to figure out, if you unravel it, where along the curve it is, which is really cool because I have basically one of those curves running through every pixel of the picture. And then I pick certain important points based on different, you know, procedural parameters that I visually, sometimes mathematically, decide on, create little areas where those shapes can exist. And that was the basis of this collection. And but because it's like all based on the same kind of hardcore fractal real-time rendering technology, the next one that I'm going to do is probably going to be 3D, and the next one I'm going to do afterwards is probably going to be trying to be realistic or fractally again. So that's kind of the progression that's in there. So from there, with, you know, mixing those kind of procedural rendering ideas with NFTs is where my friend Moyes and I were having a lot of conversations about, like, on Discord about where this is going to be, what's art going to mean, you know, what's interactivity, la, 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 all this stuff. And I was still doing a bit of this AI image generation stuff on the side, just to explore for VFX. And at one point, Moist just said, hey, why don't we should do DALL-E, we should reimagine CryptoPunks with DALL-E. I was like, hold my beer. And then I was like starting to do some stuff. And we quite quickly realized that it's fun to do and it would be an interesting project. And that's how it started. And then from there, it was this, which sounds like a quick thing to try out, you know, at a late night Discord, you know, session, turned this like 3 months journey of like quite intense work, where we, first of all, at the time, I didn't have access to, and or I don't think it existed yet, an API for DALL-E. So the first step was hack DALL-E by, you know, opening up your Chrome and going into the network part of your console and listening in what requests you see getting fired out. And we realized that it was actually quite easy. And there was just, you know, a bunch of like simple post requests to a their servers. And you could kind of sidetrack the website. And you could just basically in Python or in a command line, you could just do your own scripting. And it didn't really violate any rules because you did the same thing that the website did. You just did it from Python, and you still had to pay, you know, at that point it was you had to pay a credit per generation, so you still had to do that. You still had to pay. It's not that you wouldn't, you know, wouldn't pay. So we were pretty confident that it was all fine. And I think then they changed their attitude towards their images being sold as well. So that was done, changed. So when he had to go ahead to do that, we really started to kind of integrate DALL-E into a visual effects pipeline. So there's this visual effects tool called Nuke, written by, or coming from, like, as a compositing package that is kind of the most high-end compositing package that people use to combine images and to kind of make them look real at the very, very end of a pipeline. So what I did is, because I did lots of my deep image work in Nuke, so I kind of know Nuke pretty well, I hacked it into there as an add-on. And suddenly in your compositing package, you could type, you do in-painting by text and stuff, and I posted it online, and that kind of was done, because I now could connect DALL-E with a post-production workflow that I'm, you know, really good at. And I would then we create other, you know, post-production classic style filters and effects and more code to make the collection, which is literally take a CryptoPunk and convert it into a AI hallucinated version of it, purely based on the parameters. So it does never ever see the picture. It only sees the parameters, the attributes that they have, small, you know, cigarette smoking or whatever, cigarette, you know, straw hat, whatever it is. Like those get translated.
How did those prompts work? Because like, you know, when you were first telling me about Dunks and it, you know, first of all, it's just like, oh, okay, that's a super neat idea. Like we're taking CryptoPunks, the most iconic NFT collection, and running it through DALI. Immediately, you're like, oh, yeah, that's a neat idea. I'm surprised that hasn't been done or something like this.
Same. I think to be fair, one guy had it done at the time. We were looking into marketing it. I'm not sure if he did it before. I had no timeline available. Mm-hmm. But his Twitter existed when we tried to start to think about how to sell those, but having done most of the art already. So there's one guy who made it as well. But I don't necessarily think that he had the same ambitions that we had.
Right.
So I don't know what happened. But there's a community. I don't think it ever...
Yeah, I mean, like, there's been, I mean, for folks just hearing it now, but like, if you're kind of a citizen of the NFT world, you're familiar with like every like leading collection has like 100 sort of iterations on a theme and stuff like that. Like, it's very much of the culture. But you know, you guys are bringing heavy weapons to the enterprise, really, and doing something quite interesting. But when you were telling me about it initially, I was just like, well, that's interesting. Like, what kind of prompts are you kind of feeding into this engine to have the outputs? And you're saying, was it as simple as almost like text prompts of like, these are the traits of a given punk? Or how does it know to create a profile picture, sort of, you know, how did you guys shape that?
So there's a bunch of things that you touched on. The first thing is, what's kind of the secret sauce, or not the secret sauce, but the core of the project is how to translate an attribute of a punk into something that DALI can understand. And it's usually way more wordy than that. Because for a classic example that Moise always uses is cigarette screwed us for the longest time, because then it said cigarette and we just literally put comma cigarette in there, amongst the other stuff we already done. Let's get back to that later. But it doesn't mean there would be suddenly a guy smoking or a person smoking a cigarette. It could also be a cigarette coming out of an ear or a cigarette symbol behind them. So you have to be a bit more specific and then give it more and more and more hints to what cigarette means. And then also how it contrasts with other properties like vape. You know, what's the difference between a vape pen and a cigarette? And how do you display that? And then on top of that is the style that you want to do. So what do you want to see? A person, whatever. And then the next thing is the style, like the pixel art style. We explored lots of different styles and you can see them on our Twitter posts. Like we went to realistic, we went to pencil sketches, to comic styles, to different styles. But and while they were all cool, they were all possible. We felt at the very end that the pixel art style is the most true to the original CryptoPunks collection. And we all love, like, you know, early 90s computer games. And it's kind of what we kind of got educated on, how to hack our first computers on. So that's kind of, we love that kind of visually as well. So that's what we did. Which in hindsight is a shitty decision, because turns out DALI is really bad at making pixel art. So it was not easy to make DALI create pixel art. There's a lot of filtering going on afterwards. That's why I'm saying the whole visual effects stack. So there's a lot of like cleanup and automatic cleanup and procedural work and scripting and coding of image processing afterwards and scaling and straightening and, you know, all sorts of stuff is happening at the end. It comes with code and stuff like this, but it's not necessarily the raw output of DALI necessarily. And then the last but not least is, of course, the actual prompting, you know, what is it like? We tried, let's say, different computer games, and then you say Neo Geo, and that worked relatively well. But then you say Day of the Tentacle, and suddenly, well, this is a computer game. You and I probably know that if you say a human face or a female face smoking a cigarette, you know, in the style of Day of a Tentacle, you know what I mean, and I know what I mean. But yeah, it suddenly had tentacles growing out of people's faces, and you know that's not. It didn't work, for example. So those are different ways. And we just experimented forever, and you know, found out better things, and suddenly have a bunch of ways of telling DALL-E how to make relatively okay pixel art that we can then clean up. And it's a bit of a hand in hand between allowing an artifact or allowing a bad output and having a good fix for it, and having a good input from the get go. So sometimes I'm like, I know this looks horrible, but I know because there are certain, you know, contrasts in the colors or whatever, I can actually fix that at the back end quite easily. So I'll leave you do that. And yeah, that's how we technically came to the thing. And then on top of that, because it's completely procedurally generated and no pictures like the other, which is the whole point of the collection, is that like where the CryptoPunks are all cool and nice in the first ones, but they're very like boring in a way if you go from one to the other, because it's the same, you know, small amounts of pixels and only little changes. For us, it's like with the same attributes, you could do a different drawing and none of our dunks is like another, like they all look completely different. And the next thing we also did is we allowed conceptual changes to the art based on what the AI would give us. It's what I said at the very beginning, you know, how suddenly you as the creator have to accept what comes back rather than working against it. For example, well, that is the eye patch. I think the punks just say eye patch as an attribute, or eye, whatever I call it, like patched eye. Eye patch would always, or would very often, result into pirates. And not into eye patches. And then suddenly the hats, they had like pirate hats on, or like skull and bones behind them. So I was like, wait a second. Rather than forcing the eye patch down its throat and having, you know, trying to make it look like Nick Fury or whatever, we kind of embraced it and said, okay, cool. That means the eye patch, our system really wants to make pirates. So let's just rename this thing into pirates, but be consistent and be conceptually, you know, in a similar ballpark. And suddenly some of them might have eye patches, but not all eye patch punks have dunks that have literally eye patches, but they're all kind of pirate. So you can still group them together and they make sense. So that's kind of other, you know, other things that we allowed in the creative genesis of the project.
Yeah, cool, man. I'm curious to ask like how your experience has been since like the mint and the drop, and what kind of feedback you're getting from folks in the space, potentially, you know, people coming from the CryptoPunk community itself, you know, like anecdotally, how have people been responding to or engaging with the project and the, you know, the creation, what it is?
I think before we can go there, I think the most important part to mention is that we had a kind of an aha moment, a eureka moment, and the creation of the process where, you know, we were making this like AI stack entity that, you know, is basically just on my hard drive as a piece of code, which is like, it's good at making pixel art, but it also, I use the same thing for lots of other stuff. So it's like, it became this kind of hydra of technology that just sits here, and I kind of use different bits and bobs for different projects. And at one point late at night, I asked it, so how do you want me to call you? And then give me 10 names for it. Give me 10 names for you. And then 9 of them were like super self-aggrandizing bullshit names, the virtuoso creator and all shit like this. And number 10 was Jeff, just Jeff. So we ran with that, and basically now calling my whole technology stack here Jeff. Jeff the artist also has a Twitter handle. And Jeff is kind of the creator of the punks now. He's a part of the team. He, because Jeff is a male name, I don't think he's any sort of, he identifies as anything, but he is a you know, person on Twitter who interacts with people at, you know, certain times, sometimes more, sometimes less, does certain, you know, stands for the project and other projects. That's the cool part. So that's why I needed to introduce Jeff first, because the main part for us is that Jeff keeps growing and keeps getting interests. I'm currently, me and Jeff are currently doing another a music video, help a friend out with a music video. I'm not sure when that drops, so maybe we could link it here if it's out or not.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, there's other projects that Jeff is involved with in that kind of space. Stuff I've shown you before that we can't mention yet, stuff like this. That's all technically what Jeff's kind of helping with. So for us, the most important part is that the dunks are just one step towards Jeff and towards this experiment of a virtual entity, virtual being that just, you know, exists to make AI art and procedural art and help people, you know, in certain art projects with a tech stack that kind of keeps growing as new interesting bits come along.
This reminds me of like the TV series Silicon Valley. Have you watched that show? When I can't remember, Guilfoyle, right? And like he has his whole like server room that like has, you know, has a name and whatever, and Anton, that's right. So like he uses Anton to brute force things and stuff like that. So like personification of this kind of tech stack now, when you talk about Jeff like being on Twitter and things, I'm just like, is there possibility to kind of plug a generative text kind of thing into this tech stack? So it's also like, how, I don't know, sorry, I'm starting to just fall into ripples of like philosophical conundrums or whatever, but like somehow that's plugging a text generative thing that's coming out of this, you know, almost like I can give it a buzzword of like a neural network, the kind of stack that you've created. I think that's like super interesting, the idea that it can kind of have its own personality.
Me too, because I think actually that again, this is my I'm always thinking about the future of content creation. Sorry for my drifties, but I feel like this is a very important step towards shows of the future, where, you know, let's say at one point in the future you turn your Netflix on, and rather than getting presented with like 10 new shows for you, which are all kind of meh, and you're like, oh, I don't know, you tell it what you want to see. You say like, hey, I want Bob and Jono having an argument and then getting over it about the current state of American politics, and I want it to be directed by Jeff. Boom. And then you make a tea and you come back, and then your show is ready for you to watch, based on what you like, based on, you know, the virtual characters that you pick, that have certain traits that might be with you, that might be only yours, your own friends or your own creations, because it became so easy to make those, or they might be public figures or whatever. I think that's and that's one of the steps, because, you know, while Jeff is still a bit manual and is still, you know, there's obviously a lot of like smoke and mirrors there to get it going, all the building blocks are there. Like, we could technically kind of do something like that. Again, it will probably not look like, you know, 4K pristine footage of stuff, but it will be, you know, slowly we will get there. And that's why I think Jeff is so important, because Jeff is one of those first things that, you know, there's multiple virtual influencers, the, you know, the classic little Michaelas and Immagrams and all whatever they're called, but they're always like, they're kind of, I'm on Instagram and I'm existing there. I'm not like self-aware and self-creative, and, you know, I can't, there are good examples as well, but they're a bit different to what we're trying to do here. We're trying to be a bit more like a growing entity that can actually change and adapt, and that actually doesn't, its brand identity is not, this is my face. It's more like its brand identity is, this is Jeff, and tomorrow I might actually be a totally different face because I'm having this cool art project with this guy, and, you know, now I'm really, you know, I want to wear, you know, upside down panda hats, whatever. Like, it's fine. Like, we can totally change and adapt. And I think it's like a creative studio almost that is led by AI in a way, and by some people. And that's why the dunks are away in. And yeah.
So like, you've created Jarvis, basically. So the Iron Man theme is coming back. And So with that being a thing, so the recent Dunks Mint itself, like kind of getting back to that question, like what's the experience been like for you guys, you know, and what's been the sort of the public response?
It's been very cool to work with actually some professionals in the space, the friends from No Standing, fellow Australians who are like a marketing entity who are really good at representing those kind of projects, and we became kind of friends, and they showed an interest in the project, and we're a core part of the team, and we're kind of working together. So it was really good to see how that actually works, because so far I'm always like, here's my art, like it. And one of my very small Twitter followers can then buys it, hopefully, or as part of a bigger community, people just get exposure that way. But it was good to see how kind of doing this properly looks like. And I really enjoyed the whole war room, how the whole mint happens. Personally, I really enjoyed the project. We didn't mint out yet. I think we're like over 2/3. But we're not really bothered by that. And as I said, like we were not here or ever there to get people something to flip or put on their walls and then make hundreds of thousands of dollars of it. I mean, obviously, if that's a side project, I'm never saying this is not. I wouldn't welcome it. But it was never our idea. Was always to learn something ourselves and to push the whole space forward and to give Jeff a face, or to give the whole operation a face. Where we could then get more jobs, projects, interesting collaborations going with yourself, with others, and see if we can get Jeff to have success. Because, and then the people who were part of it from the get-go, obviously would some sort would obviously have some benefit from that, or some say in it, or whatever it is. And that's kind of what we're envisioning mainly with that. And plus, obviously, being one of the first, I never want to say the first, because if you call yourself the first, there's probably somebody else who's done it before you. But one of the first kind of completely generative collections that are completely based upon code, and where every single picture is different. Like I think that's the important part. It's like, it's not, obviously there have been lots of PFP projects and lots of other projects, but projects that are have basically a different drawing. Different hand-drawn drawing by Jeff for each entity, I think we're probably one of the first ones. And I think that was fun to do. And we all learned a lot, and we all have day jobs, and we all, have day jobs that allow us to explore those spaces, because that's what we do as a day job, as futurists or as like researchers or whatever. So it's time well spent at the end of the day. And we hope, obviously, that we will get more, that people will be, buy the last ones that are available and come along on the journey with us. There was a bunch, like I had an operation recently, and, we were a bunch of holidays, so we were not as active. Post-mint, we were kind of recovering a bit, but starting pretty much this week or next week, we will start to be very active again. And, suddenly the projects that I was working on might drop, and we can start to kind of re-engage a lot and see what the next steps are for Jeff.
Yeah, like, so for listeners of UFO, where we find ourselves in late November 2022, and Dali Punks have not yet minted out. This is just kind of like noting this line in the timeline kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, obviously all the links are in the show notes and stuff like that, so people can dive in and explore the thing. But I love that kind of, exposing the fact that you guys all have, you're all professionals doing whatever you're doing. I think this spirit of, because so much, maybe less so now, but like through the NFT space, the kind of the Fiverr art, quick mint flip, blah, 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 kind of NFT collection hype kind of thing. And it's nice when there's projects that are a little more like, we're doing this to discover things and have fun and mess around with stuff.
And I don't want to obviously discourage people of any sort of flipping projects. Like, it's cool. Like, if that's what you want to do, that's great.
Yeah,
totally. I'm not doing that. I don't flip any project. All the NFTs I own is because either I think they're cool, they stand for something, or they. Or there were friends that did them or whatever, I'm not in the flipping game. If you want to be, that's great, and that helps everybody else out, and it's awesome, but not necessarily for me, because I just can't do that. I don't have time. I have two kids, I have a family, I have a job, and I can't now start to spend all my free time on Reddit to figure out which project is the next one. I dabble sometimes, but that's not the point of it, and especially not the point of this project that I'm putting out myself. This is to slowly, you know, show people that we, in this case, are serious about what we're building there and what we and that we're interested in the space and want to collaborate. And for me, the biggest success would be if it sells out, it would be great. It would be a good achievement, of course. I won't deny that. But the biggest thing would be to actually have somebody that is really creative and positive as an attitude reach out to Jeff and be like, hey, I want to do this with you. Are you down? And then have some sort of great spin-off project that comes that brings Jeff forward, that brings the Dali Punks community forward, but also whatever the other person is that we're collaborating with is. And, you know, we have lots of talks already. Like, it's not that this is like it might happen or not, but like, I'm pretty sure we will have lots of different things happen. But, you know, that's how I would measure the success in like a year or two from now, rather than, you know, is now every Dali Punk minted and is every Dali Punk now worth 3 ETH? Like, obviously, that it would be great because it would enable us to think bigger. But because we are all very well connected in industry and all have done this for 15 plus years, you know, I think I'm very positive that there are enough opportunities along our way that we can just grab and hope that a lot of people support it.
Yeah, when you say that, you know, you would love to see like other creative projects kind of engaging with Jeff, and, you know, what might that look like? Is that folks ultimately getting in touch with the Jeff Twitter that kind of comes through to you guys, and there's potential to collaborate with like plugging into this Jeff Jarvis that you've made, at some stage kind of having an open thing that folks can just plug into that? I'm trying to catch up to understand what that might look like, the sort of the open API version of Jeff, you know?
I don't necessarily that we are in the business of making open APIs, because we are two people, and purely the support of an API, whatever it is, it probably would take more than that. So unless the state of 3 ETH per Dali Punk is reached, and we can have that time or more people, Jeff is going to be a as I said before, more like a boutique creative studio that is really much focused on AI generated procedural art. And if that's what you need to be done, then, and if you need it to be done either with a lot of budget or little budgets, because we love you or your project or what you stand for or whatever, is kind of how we would work. Again, you know, we have zero pressure of financial success. So I can totally, and to the point that, you know, my actual job is a futurist. What that means is that I'm encouraged to do crazy projects, how I feel like the future should or will be, to explore how that looks like, and then report back to HQ to tell them how it works or what it is. So that's kind of what I'm doing. So I'm allowed to be in that space already, but I have to be selective, and, you know, I can't just do everything. But long story short, I think in the short to midterm, this will be you basically reaching out to me, Jeff, or whoever, to come up with with your concept, and we can figure out and work on this together. And in the long term, obviously, if this magical future is where our Netflix shows are, you know, in parts generated on the fly with other entities together, then obviously there has to be some sort of standard that Jeff would at one point adhere to, or that we could even, you know, champion. I'm all up for that. But, you know, that's kind of the long-term goals. But that said, I'm very actively working on a project idea where I'm like trying to imagine, I'm working with different filmmakers and storytellers and stuff like this right now at a very early stage, where I'm trying to imagine how it would look like if you could change or have inputs from your users in a kind of more classic TV scenario. So you could think of it as a story that's been told, very simple, you know, conversation, you know, person walks into a bar, has a conversation, exits bar. But the good thing is we've filmed it and prepared it in a way and asking you a bunch of questions before you watch the piece. Where is it set? You know, on a crossing of the Atlantic, on a cruise liner in 1920. Okay, cool. That means, you know, I have a table that I need to replace with AI. I have a background I need to replace with AI. I have a watch on your wrist that I need to replace with AI. Okay, to make all those assets, put them all together procedurally, in 12 hours your video is ready and you can watch it on Twitch in a feed. That's kind of the idea of my own project, but I need, obviously, it's a lot of stuff that needs to be developed for that, and a lot of, obviously, it's not as simple as just saying then the story happens, because I'm a technologist and an artist, but not necessarily a writer and a storyteller. So that's where the different collaborations with people come into place, where we're currently working on. This is kind of one of many ideas that is in the pipeline, and depending how much time we're able to spend on it and who is coming on board with the idea, that's one of the things. And then there's music videos a lot. There is even games. The old Fractal experience could need a bit of, maybe we can make it even better by diving into the fractal brain of an AI with an AI. There's so many things you can do. If you have enough time and energy and the passion that we have, then you can definitely create greatness.
So something I really want to ask you about, that you've done a lot of interesting explorations in the kind of deep fake generative stuff, as we've touched on, of course, but you posted a video last week on Instagram, which I'll embed in the post for this episode on UFO.mira. And so people can take a look at it. Can you describe the creative process and execution of that piece? I suppose describe, if you could perhaps give our audience a text prompt so that it can come to their imagination if they're not on the blog post right now. But sort of, what does this video look like, and what was the kind of creative process for executing this thing, which is quite a striking effect? And I was kind of sharing that video with friends last week.
Cool. No. The cool part is that I still owe everybody a BTS video in the making of, and I've not yet had time to do it. So it's perfect, because I get some chance to explain it. So it stemmed from me exploring Dream Booth. I had to tell you the whole genesis, and then you can pick and choose what do you want out of there. But so it started with Dream Booth. When Dream Booth came on the scene, I started to make my own face into Dream Booth, just because, not because I love myself so much, but just because I have legal access to lots of pictures of myself. So I experiment a lot with, and I have a very powerful GPU from work, so I'm very lucky that, right, so I could use it quite early on. And it worked so well, and suddenly I saw myself in there, that I kind of thought, hey, wait a second, if I can make myself out of nothing, then I can, with image to image, I can also make myself on top of somebody else, which is like a deepfake. But instead of training it for years and years with lots of data, I train it, for an hour. I basically refine a stable diffusion checkpoint that has been trained for hundreds of thousands of hours or whatever. I just enhance it a bit by kind of total recalling in my head into there, and actually do it in a kind of fun way. We found out that rather than using a random combination of letters as the new token that you put into Stable Diffusion as a thing for yourself, you take somebody who is already kind of drawn well by the system. So in my case, it's Chris Evans. I know I'm not looking like Chris Evans, but I'm kind of like him. If you, from like 200 meters away, you could probably think we're similar height, similar skin color, and so on. And we picked him because he's drawn randomly really well by Stable Diffusion. Like, Stable Diffusion just knows Chris Evans really well to draw. So I replaced the word Chris Evans with my pictures in Stable Diffusion. So in my text prompt for myself, I have to actually type in Chris Evans, and then I appear, because I kind of total recall style replace the memory of Stable Diffusion's Chris Evans concept with my pictures. But it's good, because lots of the lower level concept of human, man, white dude, certain age, certain height, two eyes, one nose, see what I mean? Like, are already there, and you just build on top of it rather than having to completely start from scratch. So it looked really good. And I have this project right now that I'm trying to do for Framestore, where I work, about I'm all about like profile pictures enhancements, or how you can take people's real pictures with a prompt and then get them somewhere else. So that's kind of a project I'm exploring at the same time. So I had to do a lot of different pictures of myself, with AI art. at that time. So I made those. And from there, there sprung the idea of, like, you know, this whole deepfake test. So I got a piece of free footage of offline, of you know, some website online, and then tracked the face, cut the face off, basically, and stabilized it just by tracking the two eyes. In VFX, that it's not a very hard thing to do. And then saved those images out of just the head as a, you know, a reference basically for my head. And then I threw those into Stable Diffusion with Dream Booth and basically said, now draw Chris Evans, AKA me. So, and then the images came back and they were strikingly, you know, well translated and not really flickery, that much flickery between frames, which is really the problem is. And then I experimented a lot with different settings and different trainings for Dream Booth and different, you know, do I need more pictures and more iterations or less? Or do I, you know, what sampler do I use and which one looks better? Like, it does like 1,012 parameters that you have to kind of fine tune. And then having been a VFX artist helps there, you know, when you do water simulations and you have like 17,000 parameters of viscosity and fluidity and emission strength and all this stuff and have to make a tidal wave. It feels sometimes a bit similar to that you have lots of sliders and, you know, you kind of know what to do, but then you experiment a bit and you wedge test and stuff like this. So it feels very similar. Anyway, then once I did that, I was like, wait a second, now that I know how to do myself, I should actually just try now other people that Stable Diffusion already draws really well and see if I can do a purely text-based deepfake. And that's the face part of the video that you're referring to. I just basically replaced of this whole footage, you know, it into like five or six different, you know, Barack Obama, LeBron James, you know, other people, and pick the right timings for them and then just like let them appear. And it looks really cool. And you can just see how, going back to the initial idea of making content that kind of adapts to your thing, maybe you can at one point, you know, have an actor giving a performance, but then the performance can get contextualized in different times or, you know, whatever. And on top of that, I started to experiment a lot with a thing called Warp Fusion by, it's like a thing online. If you look for Warp Fusion, you can find it. It's a guy called Alex Spirin who invented it, and it uses what we call in VFX optical flow. So it's basically a vector fields of how pixels move over time. So if I move my hand from left to right, it would basically figure that out and get a per pixel directional of, you know, where is this pixel to be predicted in the next frame. So it uses that from the original footage to kind of warp things around, hence Warp Fusion instead of diffusion, to make a somewhat consistent image over time. It's very much simplifying it, and it's under heavy development and changes. You know, he puts out new versions on his Patreon every couple of days, so it's really like it's in development. And I kind of plugged it in and figured out that if you can create different motion vector types with VFX soft tools that are a bit more precise, you can actually get better results. And, you know, there's other VFX trickeries about mask generation and blending. And, you know, he has different outputs. And I take all the outputs and I kind of remesh them and recreate them together and stuff like this to give a better result. But that's the basic idea. So at this point, you have an actor moving, the camera moving, but you're replacing the face with whatever you call them, diffused fakes or deep diffusions or whatever we want to call them. And the body is replaced with a Warp Fusion field where, you know, again, I put some robot, crazy robot prompt, giggery robot prompt in there, just exploring what looked good and what I kind of wanted to happen. Through, you know, family ties, I'm very much, you know, exposed to fashion and the fashion industry a lot as well. And I'm very interested in how this is going to change the fashion industry. That's why I was interested in changing the clothing and the actual body. Obviously, I went all the way to a cyborg person, but you can just imagine how very simple photo shoots for generic brands can be replaced with AI-generated images of, you know, modeling your basic T-shirts and all the colors that you have and all those kind of things. Which could be even done on demand. So if you walk in the store and there's a huge billboard, because you have a wristband that shows us that you love yellow, we change the color of the t-shirt that's displayed to a yellow person. And because you're a, you know, whatever, a black girl, and that's what we use as the model, so you can see yourself how it would look on you or whatever. Like, you can see how this can kind of quite quickly go everywhere in our daily life, not just in art.
Yeah, so you're touching on that point of kind of some of these technologies starting to kind of affect the evolution of fashion into the future and stuff like that. And, you know, we're chatting about, from looking at that video output that you've made, it's kind of, it's doing its generative thing on the sneakers that the figure is wearing as well. I was just saying how that seemed like something that could influence like sneaker design or be a trend for a little while, and here and there and stuff like that. Like, it's something that looks cool as a filter or an output and stuff. And you'd mentioned that you just picked up this new like hoodie from Nike coming from like a Web3 native team. That kind of, yeah, it's interesting conceptually.
Absolutely. I bought into the sadly, I'm not a clone X for the crypto nerds, as your listeners should probably know them, but I have friends already deep in with Artifact, the company behind CloneX and behind this Nike combo. So I bought into the monolith at a time where we were doing a project together at work, and I love the way they interact and they innovate on Twitter, and how they kind of keep doing cool stuff. So I got a crypto kick from them. And then also the other day I picked up my hoodie with my NFT hoodie, which has a I was not really sure what it would be, but first of all, it's a really nice and heavy hoodie, so I needed one like that anyway. Sadly, it's gonna be, you know, as I live in the upside down, so the unique, you know, we're running into summer, so I probably need another half year before I can confidently wear that hoodie. But they have a bunch of tags on them, a bunch of QR tags, and it links to a CloneX visually inspired lens, Snapchat lens. And yeah, this is one of the next things I want to actually explore, because they have a 2-week challenge to come up with an AR experience in, you know, that's based on the tag, uses the tags well in this kind of Snapchat Spark AR environment. So I'm just trying to figure out right now how to conceptually do something that makes sense, and if I can even. But I was thinking of kind of doing some sort of Jeff-related kind of AI art-driven thing, where either I use a bunch of AI art that, you know, that's based on me modeling the hoodie. Because the good thing, the hoodie. So it's like, you know, if you can probably make something of it that is kind of, you know, special, either a 3D thing that's inspired by art or procedurally generated or something. See what I mean? I'm just trying to do something. And I was thinking with my friend who used to work for Artifact, we were like, oh, hey, we should just do something, because he has a hoodie, I have a hoodie, we should just do something and, you know, just post in our own socials. And then that night, Artifact actually posted that, hey, here is the competition. So I'm trying to join there and see if anybody has a great idea that they want to collaborate with. They can always give me a shout out to me. But I hope it gets, I think it's like a week and a half left or so, or like 9 days left till the deadline, and let's see what we can do till then.
Well, we're dropping this episode within the next 12 hours or less of recording or whatever, so if you're listening to this now and you're super early on the episode, then get involved.
No, I have a hoodie, we can test it. I have a phone and a hoodie.
There we go. That's a good idea. And like, I mean, we were chatting before about how like Artifact, it's very interesting to see that, you know, Nike had acquired that project, that it, you know, they started out, they're making like, you know, crypto sneakers kind of vibe that like in some universe through some lens is sort of inspired by Nike, if you like. And then, you know, they've since done a Nike sneaker release in collaboration or as part of the company. Now it's kind of quite a, you know, quite a standout story from the space, and, you know, it would seem like a smart acquisition by Nike itself to kind of make a huge step into the space.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's perfect, and it's a perfect example on how to do it and how to redesign and recreate that space in a smart way and weave in, you know, AR and the NFT blockchain Web3 world and fashion and brand, big brands together in a way that makes sense, and how to you really use the whole community thing well, you know, how to expand on it rather than you know, just create a community for community's sake, like to really kind of flourish like that. And I think I love watching that stuff. Like, I think for me the two most interesting things to follow in this kind of space is either Mischief or Artifact. Obviously Mischief is a bit more, you know, out there. But it's really fun how natural it comes for them to be, you know, in with technology and with the zeitgeist. And it's really cool to watch that kind of flourish.
So we'll share all these breadcrumbs and things to follow on in extensive show notes from this episode. But yeah, I'd like to thank you so much for coming on and having a conversation. And yeah, look forward to seeing where you continue to explore and discover in you know, into 2023, which feels like it's going to be quite a time.
Exactly, I think so too, and it's only going to be getting more fun.
Thanks again to Atara for coming on UFO. You can find him on Twitter at @Atara_XYZ. All the links to his projects and previous works are there. To check out Dali Punks, check the episode notes at ufo.mirror.xyz. Thanks to our sponsors who made this episode possible. To get started with Zerion and create your new crypto wallet, head to zerion.io. To join the Lens ecosystem and explore the future of Web3 social, be active around UFO, engage with us on Twitter, and looking forward to invite everyone. Subscribe and collect our NFTs at ufoclub.lens. This is Nick Hollins, signing off from UFO.